Hello and welcome to The Lit Pickers. I'm Supriya Nair, and with me is my beautiful co-host,
Dipanjana Pal. I did my sexiest voice, which sounds like I have a cold, which I really don't. But anyway,
you sound pretty sexy to me.
Make of annen. I needed to do a little bit of Elvish.
Okay. She needed to do a little bit of Elvish because our episode today is about the desperately uncool and yet somehow haunting J.R.R. Tolkien, author of The Hobbit, of The Lord of the Rings, and the creator of a world that has inspired generations of fantasy writers, sometimes in frustration, sometimes just because what Tolkien did all those years ago turned out to be unbeatable. Dipanjana, why are we talking about Tolkien?
I was just going to say that, you know, in the course of this episode, in case anyone ever thought either of us was cool, they're going to be so disabused of that notion because this is going to be geekdom at its pinnacle.
And it's not even geekdom that's like fun, right?
No, I mean, it really isn't.
Even people who like Tolkien don't generally like to admit it.
Because it is just so incredibly esoteric at many levels, but it's a very faithful club. You know, the Tolkien fans, as it were, are an incredibly loyal bunch of geeks, is what I will call us. Mm-hmm. Okay, here's the thing. Today, the whole idea of fandom, franchise following, practically, these things sound very normal in the age of Marvel and Harry Potter and blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. Tolkien did all of this, creating a world, creating a franchise, essentially, long before these terms had ever been come up with. And really, to me, the worst example of how to do this is the Harry Potter franchise. Harry Potter has a set of books, and both publishers as well as film studios have basically tried to repurpose the same set of things again and again and again and sell it, essentially. Tolkien is also a limited set of books because, well, he's dead now. And in fact, the bulk of his writing was published posthumously. Mm-hmm. And yet, you don't find anything being repurposed. You keep digging and you keep finding one little bit of a legend from Silmarillion, a little detail from The Lord of the Rings, a little bit from The Hobbit. And it's like he literally created worlds. He created a tiny little civilization from maps to scripts to histories to mythology, folklore. It's incredibly detailed. And when you think about all the ideas that he's embedded in there, and this really, for me, is the greatness of Tolkien. Like great folklore, there's enough in there that feels true to its time, which is in the past, but there's enough space in there for us to relate to it in the present.
Yeah, Tolkien didn't live in a time when climate change was as urgent a prospect as it is to us today. But one of the many things his legendarium did was to look upon despoiling the earth as, if not the original sin of mankind, then one of the original sins. Which is why I think even people, including other writers who have political disagreements with Tolkien, really see him as the forerunner of a kind of speculative fiction that's concerned with climate and with the environment in ways that people who grew up in succeeding generations couldn't quite match. The other things that people have political disagreements with Tolkien about, though, have remained relevant for a very long time. There are people who take issue with the attitudes to race in Middle Earth, with the attitudes to gender. And all of this is not just relevant, it's also spurred on a whole genre and category and a whole generation of writers of speculative fiction who've taken it up so that they can write against what Tolkien produced. Have you read Junot Diaz's The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde?
Yes.
I don't know if we're supposed to talk about Junot Diaz now since he's cancelled.
It's our podcast. We can talk about anyone we want.
But he's cancelled, right?
Yes, he is.
Okay.
But this is something for another time again. But the work still stands, I think, on its own merit.
And its merit may be decided upon by succeeding generations as they please. But to come back to what I was saying, there's a sequence in Oscar Wilde where this kid who's obsessed with Tolkien finally realizes that those red-mouthed, dark-skinned men whom the heroes are fighting, like, he's one of them.
Mm.
And that Tolkien, if he imagined him at all, imagined him to be the enemy. And he breaks down and cries. And I thought that was a really beautiful response to Tolkien and what it means for a lot of young readers of color or older readers of color to read Tolkien and realize that they don't necessarily have a place in his imagination. And if they do, it's not a very benign one.
So Tolkien published The Hobbit in 1937. He then went on to spend about 10 odd years crafting the world of The Lord of the Rings, which was published in 1954-55. Everything else was published afterwards from that world of
Middle-earth.
Yeah, Middle-earth as we know it today. Yeah.
Arda, if you like.
Yes, of course. But okay, so this is the period and there is actually no excuse for Tolkien not being aware of people of color or not being aware of racism. Both of these things were very much prevalent in that world. And in fact, racial purity was something that he was, there are letters to suggest that he was quite staunchly against this because...
Let's not forget he grew up in South Africa, right?
He did grow up. Yeah. He spent his first few years as a child. He was in South Africa, which is where, in fact, he developed a fear of spiders, which shows up later as Shalob.
Fantastic.
Yes, of course. So he grew up in South Africa. He was in combat in World War One. During which time there were a lot of people of color that were fighting as well. So again, there is no reason for him to not be aware of races. He does, however, create an overwhelmingly white world in which the bad guys tend to have dark skin, dark clothing, all of that, which is what has led to a certain the kind of criticism that you were talking about. I do think it's an overwhelmingly white world, but I think it has also been overwhelmingly fantastical. So. I don't know. I mean, for me, it
yeah,
didn't...
Yeah, I'm with you. Because Tolkien wasn't writing in competition with other modern novelists so much as trying to create a saga that was in line with the great sagas of Scandinavia and with Nordic myth. The focus on appearance and what it meant about you as a character overwhelmed a lot of his work. So, you know, the short, hairy-footed hobbits may originally have been comic, but by the time it comes to elves and orcs, you realize that, you know, the monstrosity shows up on your skin in the way that goodness or nobility shows up in your flowing hair and so on. And for a man of such a wide and capacious imagination, I suppose that exposes a limit to his imagination as much as anything else. But he wasn't trying to write against this tradition in which European literature and Christian literature decides that your face is your fortune. He was trying to write in tune with it.
So did you read these books as a child and were you fascinated by them immediately?
I read them as a teenager, which is why I've never quite been able to feel the same way about The Hobbit as I do about the other stuff, because I think you have to read The Hobbit
as a child.
As a child. And it's really quite wonderful that Tolkien and I suppose his generation of writers, rightly or wrongly, managed to create a kind of children's imagination with their work quite so marvelously. And in that sense, I think, you know, people like Rowling follow in their footsteps, even if they're fighting with their assertions. With Rowling, of course, that's C.S. Lewis that she's writing against.
And Lewis was a friend of
Tolkien's. That's right. Yeah. They were part of the Inklings Club together. They were friends and I think also competitors in some way. I read The Lord of the Rings as a teenager. What about you?
I read Hobbit as a child, read Lord of the Rings, started reading Lord of the Rings as a child and completely gave up because
It's difficult to get into.
And even as adult, I have to say, a lot of it is really boring as writing goes. There's world building and it's amazing world building. But there's a part of me that's like, Hanji said plot means where.
Yeah, and I think that's also part of why Tolkien has flourished for so long, right? It's because he wasn't really concerned with telling the story.
He didn't care about it, absolutely.
He wanted a place where he could put his made-up languages and his maps.
And it was a retreat, right? And that's what it becomes when you're reading it as well. You don't read for events. And that's why when I think Peter Jackson and Fran Walsh adapted it to film, and it was sort of announced that they were going to adapt it to film, that was the first set of anxieties that Tolkien fans had, because they were very aware that these are not event-ridden books. Mm. So when you're going to turn it into a movie, how will the feel that is so much an important part of the books and all of these Tolkien's footnotes that this is Beren and Luthien's story and therefore you must see Arwen and Aragorn in that context, you know, how are you going to make all of these references work?
And they didn't. And I think the movies stand alone because they focused on what they could focus, and which is probably why fans may love parts of the movies less than they do others.
So the movie made me singularly obsessed with Aragorn.
I see.
Because Viggo Mortensen is just so delicious, even when he's disgustingly dirty.
Them cheekbones.
Excuse me while I collapse. Okay, so
while we're reviving her,
as my hormones and blood surge back somewhere close to my brain. Okay, so Viggo Mortensen made me actually go back to the books because I was like, did I miss how hot Aragorn and Strider were in the book? And then I was like, no, because he's not the same person, you know?
He's a 90-year-old tramp, right?
Yeah. And he's a 90-year-old tramp who's like, I don't want to work. Don't make me take on kingship. Please, for crying out loud, just let me be with my mud, you know.
And my girlfriend.
That too.
But he couldn't get the girl without the kingship. So.
These are the problems, you know. So that was one thing that I realized, that I hadn't misread Lord of the Rings, but that the book was changing certain notions of heroism the way it had inherited it, right? The traditions of, you know, the Beowulf saga is something that, you know, we keep referring to because Tolkien translated it. That kind of very sort of active, violent heroism is something that Lord of the Rings actually works against. These are far more contemplative, unwilling heroes. Strider / Aragorn is a good example of that. Gandalf is a great example of that.
Frodo
himself. We tend to, because the films have sort of, you know, informed so much of the imagination since in a good way, but we tend to forget that Frodo is a middle-aged guy when he heads off on this quest. He's not a fresh-faced Elijah Wood by a long shot.
Right. I suppose he's fresh-faced by Hobbit standards. But
no,
yes.
That's the thing. He's not a young, young Hobbit.
No, he's an adult.
Yeah. He's grown up, you know.
That's true. Yeah, whether it's Frodo saying, you know, I wish it need not have happened in my time, or Faramir saying, I love not the arrow for its swiftness, nor the sword for its sharpness. I love only what they defend. I think this was Tolkien melding the ethos of the Nordic sagas with the morals of Christianity.
Faramir, I think, is a character that suffered tremendously in the films, by the way. I mean, he's such an interesting character in the books.
Yeah, they couldn't. And the Faramir and Eowyn story, which I think is perhaps one of the most humane love stories to have ever come out of any fantasy fiction, does kind of get...
It just gets butchered in the film. The film did... because they had to cast women in the franchise
willy-nilly,
it ended up creating roles that were not there in the book. So Arwen is a great example. She ends up doing a lot of what Glorfindel does in Flight to the Ford.
Not a bad...
And it's not a bad thing at all. Similarly, Galadriel gets a lot more play. Galadriel is a very important character in Tolkien's worldview as well, given she is a ring bearer and incredibly powerful and all that. But she comes across as a character that's far more involved and has a lot more agency. Eowyn gets a lot more play, even though her love story doesn't get treated quite as well. The other thing that the film does a lot of is introduce elements of violence that are just not there in the book. And this was something that I was far more conflicted about, even though I did love the films on their own.
I think in a Hollywood movie, you have to take a certain joy in sword fighting and, you know, horseback riding that...
And here's the thing, Saruman and Gandalf fighting, that sort of duel that they have.
Oh, I remember, yeah.
Stunning, stunning
special
scene.
Special effects.
Yeah. But so wrong for the book, you know, because it's like Saruman and him don't fight like that, you know. So about the world building, we've inherited by virtue of being Indians, a very rich folkloric tradition, which does a lot of world building rather effortlessly. For you, when you read Lord of the Rings, or when you just go through, I don't know, did you read Silmarillion?
Yes.
It helped me get over insomnia. But again, I want to love this book. And I do when I remember what I've read. But the process of reading it was hard. Because again, nothing happens. But a world is built with such grace.
And I suppose we can't really blame Tolkien for the demerits of the Silmarillion, because he never meant to publish
it. He didn't, yeah.
You know, he died, and everything that's published after that has been put together by his son Christopher and the Tolkien estate. And what we have is episodic and really stuff that contributes to expanding the mythology of Middle-earth rather than telling us meaningfully about a story that establishes some kind of continuity.
But what it does beautifully, and this is what I love about the Tolkien universe, is that let's say you're looking up one character, right? One character will lead to another character, and there's as deep a story for that second character as there was for the first.
Yeah.
And so this kind of nested mythology, that's lovely.
And Tolkien went at it so hard that I think he just set the bar impossibly high for other fantasy writers to come. Because I'm not saying that people haven't come close to accomplishing what he did, but you really have to own it. And I think starting with an element as crucial as language and building a universe around it helps you create something that's far more integrated than saying, oh, I have this lovable rogue and now I'm going to go back 30 generations and tell you.
And it's not just one language, right?
No.
He constructed with alphabets and grammar at least two languages. He has references to about 15 dialects in there. The fact that you can have conversations in Elvish, all right? I mean, I'm not even saying write your name in Elvish script, but you can have proper conversations in Elvish, I think is magnificent.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because it's like, so again, like I said, it was published in 1954. You can still have a conversation in Elvish.
You can, that's right.
You can barely do that with English a lot of the times. So, I mean,
you can have fights about whether you want to speak in Quenya or Sindarin.
Yeah.
Although I think Sindarin
kind of Elvish are you? Yeah.
Yeah, it's much better established. Because Quenya is a forgotten language even by the time of the...
It's forgotten in the books.
Yeah, pretty much. Exactly. It's the Latin of the Lord of the Rings.
So, for you, who are the inheritors of the Tolkien legacy?
There are none. What about you? What do you think?
I don't think anyone's done it as well, quite honestly. For me, the closest would be Ursula Le Guin.
Thank you for bringing up Ursula Le Guin, because I think she matches and exceeds Tolkien as a moralist.
For sure.
And I think having a moral core to the universe that you create is, again, something that not everyone is interested in and not everyone can do. I've been reading Ken Liu's Silkpunk fantasy, which I highly recommend. And it's a great deal of fun. And Liu is very talented at, you know, the technical aspects of world building. But I don't think even if he saw himself as in some kind of debt to Tolkien, I don't think he'd be ready to acknowledge it, because the... And that's totally legitimate, because he shouldn't have to. But I think just knowing that you can dream in a capacity that wide and that you can be that serious about an imaginative world space, I think that's something that generation after generation has inherited from Tolkien. And he really did it first. Yeah.
Do you think he still holds up, though? Like, do you think, because sometimes I feel like the fandom is actually what keeps Tolkien's works more alive than the works themselves.
What do you mean when you say fandom?
By fandom, I mean, you know, people geeking out, people like you and me, sort of, you know, crumpling a little bit with admiration at him. Because like I said, like, I do feel that the texts themselves are incredibly rich, but not incredibly gripping.
But isn't it unlikely that girls in our position, practically a world away from Tolkien, could still find those books and lose ourselves in them?
No, because I lose myself quite easily in Norse mythology. I lost myself quite easily reading the Edda. And the Edda's a little bit older.
Except that what Tolkien wrote was essentially like, you know, novels, shaggy novels, but he was...
Shaggy being the key phrase there for me. Mm. But that's the thing. I mean, I sometimes wonder about whether it's what he sparks in our imagination more than what he did himself write. Mm. So for me, there's a little bit of a separation between what Tolkien imagined, which I think is extraordinary, and Tolkien the writer, mm. right? So Tolkien, the creator of the legendarium, mm. is somebody that I think is incredible and I don't think has had a parallel. Tolkien the writer, on the other hand, I'm far less impressed by, because I feel like as a writer, he didn't do his legendarium justice.
Mm. And I guess he wasn't really thinking about doing it justice in the way, you know, modern readers would expect.
Possibly, yeah. Possibly. But I mean, there's just, you sort of see how much of detail he's packed into it. And also just these certain ideas, like there's no magic in that sense that happens in any of his books. Mm. There is magical stuff.
Yeah, like magical objects.
Yeah. Mm. But there isn't like zap that and zoop this. You know, there are no wands. There's no crackling electricity.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah. And I mean, even the all-powerful villain can't really, like, he can't squash like a tiny hobbit and his helper, right?
Yeah.
Until the end,
yeah.
Because there are limits to what he can do.
The fact that he's formless. Mm. The Sauron loses his form, which at one point held the capacity to charm and be pleasing to the eye, mm. It loses his form. And in that formlessness is both his ugliness, but also his power.
Mm, yes.
These are incredibly powerful ideas. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that doesn't get articulated well enough in the writing.
Yeah, there are no deus ex machinas, basically.
Yeah.
A phrase Tolkien would have hated because he hated romance languages with a passion. He thought Latin was the enemy of the Nordic languages and was the downfall of the English.
And that's why a lot of the names and language in the Middle Earth world go back to Old English.
That's right.
You know?
Yeah.
Frodo. Yeah.
Bilbo.
And sort of glorifying,
Arwen.
Yeah, glorifying what was looked down upon by the sort of veneration of the classics, essentially, which he taught.
Yeah, and in this, Tolkien and his mythos were a product of their time. He was a rebel. I suppose Middle-earth is one of those places that changes every time you revisit it. And maybe it's the mood we're in, you know, 100 years after the First World War. Or maybe it's just that it's just where I am, but when I go back to The Lord of the Rings now, I see it as perhaps one of the greatest texts to emerge out of the First World War, on par with perhaps the poetry of Wilfred Owen or Sassoon. Because I think the sort of pain and the lack of redemption to be found in war is something that can only be written by, you know, by a soldier who realizes that victory is impossible in violence.
Indeed. And when you think of the end of The Lord of the Rings.
Mm. Which left out of the movies.
Indeed. Scarring of the Shire is not in the movies. Mm. So this glorious trilogy essentially ends with four broken people steeped in melancholy and so desperately relieved to have made it there, despite their melancholy. Mm. And there's something incredibly beautiful about that.
Unforgettable.
On that wistful note, I'm not going to speak any more Elvish. No, actually, I might. But you've been listening to The Lit Pickers with Supriya and me. We are on Instagram. We are on Twitter. We may geek out on Tolkien, but we do like technology. So look us up. It's Supriya Nair and it's Dipanjana Pal. And we will be back with more lit picking and nitpicking soon.
For now, Namarie.
Namarie.
This is a Made in India production. The editorial producers are Mae Thomas and Sean Phantom. Shania Subramanian is our producer and the assistant producer is Janam Devan. These episodes are edited by Vijay Doifure and recorded by Adriel George, as well as the Island City Studio. Our theme music is Here's to You by the Easy Wanderlings.